Good evening, everybody. My name is Stephen Wolfolk. I'm the Director of Programming and Marketing at the Kansas City Public Library. Well, thank you all very much for being here, and we hope you have a good time. We hope you come back to see us soon. Before we get started, I need to make one quick announcement. As many of you might already know, especially if you follow the library on social media, we've made the decision to suspend our public programming after tonight's event through at least the end of March. As we near the end of the month, we'll reassess and see if an extension is necessary. This was not an easy decision for us to make. We're grateful that so many people consider our public programming to be an important part of their educational and cultural experience. But with health professionals increasingly urging us to avoid large gatherings, we ultimately decided that we had no other choice than to play whatever role, whatever small role we could in slowing the tide of the COVID-19 virus. Our guest tonight is the author of Driving While Black, African-American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. I can say sincerely that this is probably in the top 10 of the books that we've had at the library in the last 12 months or so. It's a welcome addition to a new genre of books that sometimes I feel as though were written just for me or for people like me. That being those of us who understand that our country has a troubling history on matters of race and that problems still exist today, but who struggle sometimes to understand the scope and the depth of those problems, both historic or current. Soren offers a history of the mobility challenges faced by African Americans, from slaves being confined to master's property, to free black people being stopped and questioned, even kidnapped and arrested, to prohibition on train and bus travel. She goes on to explain how important access to an automobile was to African Americans that were looking to evade the dangers of a racist society. And she details how travel guides, such as the famous Green Book, and businesses catering to black Americans helped usher in a new way of resisting oppression. I hope you'll give the book a look. It's available for sale outside, courtesy of our friends of the library, but it's also available for checkout through the library, and I would urge you to read it. Gretchen Soren is a distinguished professor and director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program at the State University of New York. She has curated innumerable exhibits, including at the Smithsonian, the Jewish Museum, and at the New York State Historical Association. Again, Driving While Black is available outside, and she'll be signing copies following the event. Please join me in welcoming to the Kansas City Public Library, Gretchen Soren.
Well, it's good to see the stalwart folks out here.
We're not afraid.
I'd like you to listen to a little bit of Christian Automobile, if I can get it to work. This is a song by the Dixie Hummingbirds. It's a Philadelphia group, and it's called Christian Automobile. And in this, the Hummingbirds compare the automobile to their faith and to Christianity. So that's Christian Automobile. And in thinking about coming here today, I found something in the New York Times on March 9th that I thought was a very appropriate quotation. And I'd like to read it to you. Italy is beginning perhaps the largest restriction on the free movement of people ever attempted in a Western democracy in peacetime to try to slow the spread of the virus. And in the United States, where the Trump administration has come under criticism for sending conflicting messages on the crisis and failing to prepare adequately for its arrival, some government officials said that tighter restrictions on people's movements might be needed. New York Times, March 9th, 2020. I'd like you to think about restrictions on mobility. When we think about civil rights, when we think about our rights as citizens, we think about freedom of religion and freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. But we don't often talk about freedom of mobility. And that's what I'd like to talk about this evening. The freedom of mobility is something that we all take for granted. So the idea that you can move wherever you want to go, think about what it would mean if you couldn't come here tonight, if you couldn't go where you want to go. Mobility is something that's really essential in a free society. We're also going to talk about the Negro Motorist Green Book, which I'm sure you've heard a lot about. Many of you have probably seen the movie. The Green Book is not as important, perhaps, in this story as it is emblematic of the large variety of green books and other travel guides that existed. So there were dozens and dozens and dozens of travel guides. But we'll talk about those as well. So I'd like you to think about the notion of journey for African Americans and what that journey means. It's both the physical act of travel that's represented by real places, for example, the journey from Africa to the New World. But I'd also like you to think about the metaphorical journey, the idea of journey from slavery to freedom, or the journey to full citizenship. Journey, the idea of travel and journey, is essential as a part of African American identity. And it's emblematic in song. It appears in the blues, it appears in jazz. And this is Ma Rainey, and what you were listening to was Traveling Blues. She also sang songs like Walking Blues and Runaway Blues. But within African American music, you can often hear about travel. And travel is central to every African American experience. Any discussion of mobility must begin with a discussion of slavery. The ordeal of the Middle Passage and enslavement begins the journey, and it begins the notion for African Americans of mobility and what mobility means. And the idea of forced travel shapes African American identity. And this is a pass. So when Africans were enslaved in the United States, you had to have a pass to travel. And this is an example of a pass from 1843. And it says, please to let Benjamin McDaniel pass to Dr. Henkel's in Newmarket, Shenandoah County, Virginia, and return on Monday or Tuesday next to Montpelier for Mrs. Madison, that's the wife of the president, June 1st, 1843. Travel for African Americans was always strictly controlled and regulated. The freedom to travel, the freedom to seize the right to travel, became an important aspect of freedom and later of middle-class black identity. This painting is called Ride for Liberty by Eastman Johnson. It's from 1862. The stories of the flight to freedom on the Underground Railroad, both real and those that take on mythic proportions, carry the idea of journey into the 19th, 20th, and even into the 21st centuries, and become stories of personal agency and heroism in the face of overwhelming oppression, the oppression of African Americans. So travel becomes one way that African Americans seized their freedom. They stole themselves, they ran away. In the 20th century, the idea of journey takes the form of the Great Migration, the next stop. This is the story of the greatest mass movement of people in United States history, seeking job opportunities in the North and fleeing racism and poverty in the South. As many as 6 or 7 million African Americans left their homes seeking refuge in such cities as Chicago, New York, Detroit, Philadelphia, Newark, New Jersey, where my parents settled. With expanding opportunities in education and employment, more and more black citizens joined the ranks of the black middle class. Disposable income made leisure travel possible. Travel continued to define and represent freedom for black people, the freedom of mobility, to go where you wanted, when you wanted. But it also came to mean the ability to avoid the indignity of the Jim Crow railroad car or the segregated bus. But keep in mind, in the first half of the 20th century, the behavior of African Americans was proscribed by geography and by custom. If you were from a particular place, you knew that there was expected deference to white people. You knew what the rules were, and the rules changed from place to place depending on where you were from. Each state had its own rules. Some communities had their own rules. Each community had expected etiquette. Emmett Till didn't know the rules of racial etiquette, for example, and that's why he ended up being murdered. Particular driving etiquette was also expected. African Americans faced segregation in most aspects of public travel and accommodation in the South, overtly in the North. In the South overtly, and in the North, it was by custom. So you didn't necessarily know where you weren't welcome, but you had to learn those rules. So in the North, there was plenty of de facto segregation. Buses, taxis, trains, cabs, restaurants, beaches, even libraries, just about any space where people gathered, any space of public accommodation, were segregated. As I was doing this research, I just kept coming across more and more places that were segregated. Some of them were so silly that it was just hard to imagine. For example, segregated phone booths. This one is from Lincoln, Nebraska. Even phone booths and vending machines. Vending machines were segregated. Silly, I know. It seems unbelievable. African Americans were forced to ride in the Jim Crow rail car, insulting, filthy, humiliating. But also, they were only supposed to run in the South, but many ran in the North as well. If you can imagine, the conductors didn't want to have to ask African Americans to move to the Jim Crow Railroad car when they got to Washington, D.C. So they would put them in the Jim Crow Railroad car when they were in New York or on the way south. African Americans found that trains throughout the country were segregated. The Negro cars were often placed right behind the engine so that they were belching out smoke that went right into the Negro car. As African Americans reached the middle class, they started to purchase private cars in large numbers. Travel by car meant that you could control your own mobility, avoiding embarrassment and the insults of the train's conductor and of the bus driver. So by the 1950s, the interstate highway system enabled upwardly mobile black families to be travel consumers, just as they were consumers of refrigerators and television sets and coffee percolators. They used their travel dollars to purchase automobiles and campers and hotel rooms and restaurants. They, with their history of forced travel, it was important to the black middle class to be able to travel for leisure, to be able to go on vacation. They chose to travel because they could afford to travel. Often, parents worked really hard to make sure that their children were unaware of the humiliation that they faced when they went out on the road, and they protected them. So it was interesting, in the research that I did, I interviewed two generations. I interviewed the generation that was driving, that generation in the front seat, my parents' generation, and then I interviewed people like myself, who were the people in the back seat, those people who were unaware of what was going on out there in the world. But what car should you buy? If you were African American, what car should you buy? Everyone wanted a car. How did race affect automobile choice? According to a series of market studies of African Americans conducted in the 1940s and 1950s by market research firms for the black press, black motorists preferred Buicks and Oldsmobiles, not small cars. African Americans preferred large cars because they offered protection, a place to sleep if necessary, and a space to carry all the supplies that you had to carry in your car. Water for the radiator, gasoline in case you couldn't stop at a gas station, extra fan belts, a big cooler of food. My parents had one of those big, heavy metal Coleman coolers. A can to pee in if you couldn't stop at the gas station. Blankets and pillows. Black motorists created a home away from home in their cars, and so you needed a large automobile. For African Americans, the choice of cars was very important. The bigger, the better. Cars became rolling living rooms. And this is an ad for the Buick Electra. It shows how large and roomy these cars really were. And the ad says, "All the Electra lacks is a fireplace." When civil rights worker Medgar Evers needed a car to travel through rural Mississippi, he chose the Oldsmobile Rocket 88. The Rocket was large enough to enable Medgar to stretch out for the night on the seats because he was over 6 feet tall, and it responded immediately when he hit the gas pedal, enabling him to get away from a pursuing car. And this is what the Rocket 88 looks like. Of course, you're all aware that Medgar Evers died beside his car in his driveway, shot by a sniper. And this is the hole in the car window. Shot on June 12th, 1963, with his Cadillac. Now, I'm sure you've heard the stereotype of African Americans driving Cadillacs. African Americans drove Cadillacs in exactly the same proportion as white Americans, 3%. That's it. But because of attitudes toward African Americans, popular performers like Chuck Berry and Mahalia Jackson and Sammy Davis Jr., who could well afford to purchase Cadillacs, felt that they needed to justify in their biographies why they owned Cadillacs. The automobile was also a symbol of class status for all Americans. But for African Americans, who were often prevented by discrimination from purchasing houses because of redlining, they couldn't get mortgages. Did I do that? Yep. They couldn't get mortgages. Their cars became their largest purchase and their most important purchase, since they couldn't buy a house. They put their disposable income into expensive cars when they were prevented from purchasing real estate. For African Americans, travel by car also posed a paradox. African Americans had the freedom to travel, but they were forced to stay in segregated black neighborhoods and in segregated black tourist accommodations when they did travel. Now, I'd like you to imagine what African American life and what American life in general was like before there were automobiles. Most people in the country stayed put. They didn't travel far from home. There certainly were trains, but most people didn't travel far from their own neighborhoods. White people generally stayed in white neighborhoods. Black people stayed generally in black neighborhoods. In some poor neighborhoods, black and white people lived side by side, or black people lived on the property of white people. But the country was generally segregated by race. With their automobiles, African Americans started to crisscross the country, traveling through white spaces to get from one safe black space to another safe black space. They had to go through a variety of white spaces where they were unwelcome. They faced signs and billboards and posters and objects that ranged from insulting to terrifying. They asserted their rights to unfettered travel by going where they wanted, when they wanted. So you can imagine how much courage it took just for an African American family to go out on the road. Here are some examples of the signs. The landscape for African Americans was fraught with psychologically and emotionally damaging messages. This was a typical sign, "Welcome to Klan Country." You can imagine how frightening that would be. The originator of this road's name saw it as a sort of peace offering that represented the coming together of the North and the South after the big war. For white Northerners, the name Dixie came to represent the reunification of the Union. But for white Southerners, the road represented the persistence in the modern world of their old glory and the Southern idyllic past. African Americans saw the Dixie Highway very differently. It reminded them of a terrifying and disgraceful period in American history before emancipation. The name of the Dixie Highway both humiliated and frightened black people. Just thinking about the Dixie Highway and what its name meant scared journalist John Williams during his car trip around the country. He said, ominously, all directions to Nashville were via the Dixie Highway. Where did it end? The Dixie Highway, in a cotton patch surmounted by a Confederate flag and an a cappella choir of white citizens' council members singing Dixie. And this was a popular fast food chain on the West Coast. I know, it's horrifying, isn't it? Diners entered the restaurant through the giant coon's mouth. And this was the banner across Main Street in Greenville, Texas. The blackest land, the whitest people. One traveler to Greenville during her childhood found the experience of this banner one of the worst memories of her young life. She says, I grew up in Texas during Jim Crow. During that time, going on long distance road trips had a distinct flavor for blacks, and I remember it vividly. The packing enough food for the entire trip, no restaurants. The using the bathroom on the side of the road, no gas stations. The sleeping in the car on the side of the road, no motels. But my most vivid memory of my car trips in Texas was the sign I read every time we went through Greenville, Texas, the blackest land, the whitest people. Jim Crow signs provided warnings to black people that delineated black space and white space, that told them where they were unwelcome. And of course, some African American travelers also faced intimidation and real dangers. And this is, can you imagine encountering this group? It takes a minute to see what's going on here. And this is a fair in Colorado. I'd like to tell you a little story that was one of the stories in the book that I think is so interesting. A young boy, his grandmother died, a grandfather, and they're headed to the funeral. They're going from California to Florida, and they're going by car. He's 9 years old. He's with his aunt and uncle, and he's the only one in the car that can read. The aunt and uncle can't read. So they head out in this big Chrysler, and they make a wrong turn near Waco, Texas. And they pull onto the main street of Waco, and there's something going on. There's a lot of people in town, and there's something, clearly something going on. So all their faces are glued to the side windows, and they're trying to figure out what's happening. And as they go very slowly past, they see that what's happening is a burning. They're good white citizens of the town are about to light a black man on fire. They've got wood piled up around him, and there's a big mob, and they're about to light him on fire. And they see the car moving slowly past, and somebody takes a look, and they see that there are black people in the car, and they scream out, there are some more niggers, let's get them. And as they all go running for their trucks and their cars, you can imagine making a K-turn with that big Chrysler. So he turns it around, and they take off, and the townspeople are chasing them. And the only reason they don't get caught is that they hide in some tall corn for the night with the lights off. And they're terrified, they're trembling. What's the first thing they do when they get back to California? But generally, when African Americans are traveling, they try to stick to the interstates. They try not to go in the little towns, through the little towns, because you don't know how you'll be received if you're in a little town. And then imagine what happens if you have a car accident. In the 1950s, there are only 200 black hospitals in the United States. 200. So if you happen to be in a place where there's no black hospital and the white hospital will not receive you, you're in big trouble. Bessie Smith died as a result of an accident in 1923. Her arm was almost completely severed, and she was not accepted at a white hospital. The nature of hospital and ambulance care for African Americans profoundly affected many motorists as they traveled. And there are dozens of stories that document the unnecessary injuries and deaths in accidents as a result of Jim Crow neglect and hospital segregation. Ambulances were also segregated. And if there was an accident in a town, the first thing that the dispatcher would ask was, is the person black or is the person white? Because they had to dispatch either the black ambulance or the white ambulance. And if it was a car accident in which the white, a white person and a black person were both involved, the white ambulance had to be dispatched first, and the black ambulance was not dispatched until after the people from that were taken away from the white ambulance were taken away. So it could be 45 minutes or even an hour before the black ambulance was even dispatched. Some colleges even refused athletic competitions for fear that their athletes might not return to campus alive after traveling to some parts of the country. Negro players have experienced the greatest difficulties in securing medical care and hospitalization, reported the Atlanta Daily World about accidents occurring during travel. In 1947, an ambulance transported two students from Clark College seriously injured in an automobile accident 14 miles to a hospital in Manchester, Tennessee. Refused admission on the pretext that the hospital was at capacity, the ambulance then conveyed the two students 30 miles further to the University of the South hospital that offered first aid and then sent them on their way again. Finally, a third hospital, 50 miles from the original accident, offered treatment to the two young men. And this is an example. Some white hospitals were willing to treat African Americans, but they had very limited Negro wards, as they were called. And if the Negro ward was full, they would accept no more patients, even those who were seriously injured. So Mark Twain in The Innocents Abroad said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice." And Victor Green, a publisher from New York City, adopted that mantra for his book, The Negro Motorist's Green Book. The Negro Motorist's Green Book was a little travel guide, and it was an opportunity for African Americans to find places that they could stay safely and where they would be welcomed. This is Victor and Alma Green. Green was a postal worker in northern New Jersey and later in Harlem. He was also a businessman. He sold trinkets, he sold African sculpture, and Alma was always a part of his business. And I always like to show Alma because Victor Green dies in 1960, and after Victor dies, Alma runs the business. Even though it's still called the Green Book, even though everyone considered Victor Green the leader of this business, it was Alma who did a lot of the running of the business. And in the mid-50s, Victor Green, I don't know what happens to him. I don't know if he has a stroke or if he has a heart attack, but he really steps down from the day-to-day operation of publishing. And you can imagine, in the 1950s, it was unheard of to have a woman in publishing. And yet, Alma Green and these four women, this was the staff of the Negro Motorist Green Book. So we always talk about Victor Green, about the Green Book as a male-owned business, but it really was a business that was run by women. The Green Book included gas stations, it included hotels and motels, guest houses, tourist homes, restaurants, clubs, YMCAs, churches, doctors, dentists, beauticians, barbers, and each article, each booklet usually included one article about a community, about recommendations for travel, one article. But you should be aware that there were dozens of travel guides. The Green Book was just the longest lasting. There was a guide called Travel Guide. There was one called The Negro Traveler, The Bronze American. There were dozens of them. African Americans also found out about tourist homes and guest houses and places they could stay in the back of newspapers. African American newspapers provided guidance, as did African American magazines. So there were lots and lots of sources of information about places that African Americans could stay when they traveled. And there were guidebooks that were before the Green Book, and there were guidebooks that were after the Green Book. But the Green Book was so successful because of Victor Green's long-standing relationship with Standard Oil. James Jackson, Seated, and Wendell Alston were special marketers that were hired by Standard Oil to market Esso gasoline to the black community. And they depended on the Green Book, and they marketed the Green Book, and they entered into a contract with Standard Oil so that they could buy Green Books. And they bought thousands of copies of the Negro Motorist Green Book and circulated them at Esso gas stations. And that is the reason that we all know about the Green Book and not about all of the other travel guides. Victor Green marketed his Green Book through postcards like this that he sent around encouraging people to buy his Green Book. He sent out annual letters encouraging people to tell him about good places they had stayed. If they stayed in a nice hotel or tourist home, he encouraged them through his letters to send him the name and address of the tourist home. And he also hired agents. And he hired agents. This was a very smart thing, I think. He hired agents who worked for historically black colleges and who booked all of the musical acts. So who worked for Fisk, who worked for the woman who booked the Blind Boys of Alabama, who booked the Cotton Blossom Singers, who booked the Fisk Singers. He used those people because they knew the places around the country that would allow African Americans to stay there. And he used them as agents. So Green cultivated the black middle class, as you can see from this cover from the Green Book, which has this beautiful couple with their matched luggage. And you can see their little suburban house in the background and their car, just a little bit of their car. The Green Book was published from 1936 until 1966. Longest lasting of all of the travel guides. Also, out of this system of oppression, out of this system of segregation, is an economy that white people were very unaware of. It's a separate black economy that really existed parallel to the white economy. And they're businesses designed to provide services to black travelers and black communities under segregation. Demonstrating the resilience, black people established an entire separate world, relatively unknown to white Americans. And that was a world of restaurants and hotels and guest houses and tourist homes and cab companies and motels and theaters. Just about anything you could imagine, African Americans created these businesses to serve the black community. And this is, if any of you have been to the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., you've seen this rock, the rock from Rock Rest. Rock Rest is a tourist home in Kittery, Maine, and it was one that was a very, very popular resort that Hazel and Clayton Sinclair created from the 1950s to the 1970s, and the rock is now at the Smithsonian. And here you can see ladies, fancy ladies in their beautiful hats, enjoying a luncheon at Rock Rest. The Sinclairs also made money by catering for the white community in Kittery. And this is a typical 1950s style motor inn, a motel, where you pull your car right up to your door. You've all seen, you all remember these kinds of places. They build themselves as the South's finest Negro court. Most of the businesses were black-owned, but some were white-owned. White liberals owned some, but catered only to black people. As you got further and further west, There were fewer and fewer places listed in any of the travel guides where African Americans could stay. So as you got into the western states, before California, it was very hard to find places to stay. And there were relatively few. And most of the national parks are out there. African Americans have never been big visitors to the national parks. And the National Park Service is still trying to figure out how to get more African American visitors to go to the national parks. When I asked people why they didn't go to the national parks, they said, "Why would a black person go into the woods?" When you don't know who you will encounter there. One of the people that we were working on this documentary film about this, and one of the people said, "This idea of a neck in the woods is just kind of frightening. So African Americans don't like going into the woods alone." The other issue is that the national parks have always billed themselves as open to everyone. Right? National parks, everyone can go to the national parks. They are federal facilities. They're not controlled by the states. It's true. The national parks have always been open to everyone. The problem is that all of the private concessions in the parks, the hotels, the restaurants, the cabins, are operated by private concerns. And they were all segregated. And there was one amazing story of a group of nuns who were traveling west to see the national parks in a van with their black driver, and they stopped at one of the national parks, and they went in to have lunch, and all the nuns are sitting around the table with their black driver, and their black driver was asked to leave because he wasn't allowed to sit and eat with them in the dining room. So this is a very grainy picture, but it's actually the only photograph known to exist that shows that the national parks were segregated, and it shows picnic grounds for Negroes in Shenandoah National Park. This is Cliff Wharton, who was the chancellor of Michigan State. He was the chancellor of State University of New York. He was the president of TIAA-CREF and undersecretary of state under President Clinton. And he borrowed a line from photographer Gordon Parks. And Gordon Parks said he used his camera as a weapon. And Cliff Wharton said to me that African Americans used their automobiles. They used travel as a weapon. They used it as a weapon to open up the country. It was the black middle class. It was a soft protest. It was the way for the black middle class to begin to open up the country and to encourage desegregation. They encouraged it with their automobiles by traveling, and they encouraged it with their dollar bills, because the black middle class becomes a significant and substantial market. So scores of middle class African Americans, those who were on the front lines of the civil rights movement and those who were not, used travel as a way to quietly defeat prejudice. They crossed into white space. They took their families to national monuments and museums and resorts. They became consumers of travel like other Americans. The Green Book proclaimed the belief that travel defeats prejudice by bringing black Americans into contact with white Americans and by using the power of the dollar to convince white businesses that they were a source of revenue. But that was also dangerous. This is an ad from the Green Book, and it shows you Ware's supermarket in Memphis. Ware used the Green Book to tie himself to Martin Luther King to get business from the black community. But this could be dangerous, because tying yourself to the movement in the 1960s, sorry, I should put my hand behind my back, could be dangerous. It could have resulted in the vandalism of his store, or the bombing of his store, or he could have been physically hurt. And this is jazz musician Al Hibbler. He's at the front of the line. Civil rights workers, if you think about it, When civil rights workers went south, they had to have places to eat. They had to have places to stay when they traveled and when they participated in protests. And Al Hibbler here is participating in this protest. He was staying at the Gaston Motel in Birmingham, Alabama. And this is the A.G. Gaston Motel after it was bombed shortly thereafter. Gaston's Motel provided a room for civil rights workers to meet. Martin Luther King and the other civil rights workers used to meet in room number 30 of the Gaston Motel. Room number 30 was the room that was bombed. King was not there at the time. So it took courage both to travel, and it also took courage to provide places for civil rights workers to eat and for civil rights workers to stay, or even to be known to support the movement. And I want to say one other thing about women. Many of the women in the South who were working for white families as cooks, as maids, as laundresses, at night they would go home and they would cook food. They baked pies. They made coconut cakes. They made sandwiches. And they sold that food, much of it, to white people who had no idea that they were taking that money and putting it into the civil rights movement. People who did not want, there would never have supported the civil rights movement, were supporting the civil rights movement by buying those delicious pies and cakes and sandwiches and fried chicken, which I thought was a great irony. I loved it. And middle-class African Americans used their cars as weapons in civil rights. So here's another example. During bus boycotts, and this is a photograph from the Montgomery bus boycott, automobiles, you needed automobiles to transport people to work. Think about it. If you wanted to, and this is such a big city, I think about, wow, you could really, you know. Birmingham was a big city. Montgomery was a big city. People couldn't walk to work. If they were going to stay off the buses, they needed a way to get to work. The civil rights workers purchased a small fleet of automobiles, and they used those automobiles to transport people to work so they did not have to take the buses. It was individuals also contributed by individuals that owned cars, picked up people and drove them to work. So these automobiles, and this was done in Montgomery, it was also done in Florida, Tallahassee, it was done in other cities where they needed to create a boycott. Automobiles were used to carry people to work. In the Montgomery bus boycott, they were able to cut the revenue of the bus company by 69%. It's an enormous amount of revenue, and the bus company actually went out of business the following year. So the automobile was really a weapon in the arsenal of civil rights. And this is the Jenkins microbus. It was used by the Jenkins family in South Carolina. Now, if you think about it, if you were registering voters, if you were going around and you had a mobile clinic to vaccinate children, you were teaching people how to read, and you were teaching people how to pass those poll tests that were required to vote if you were an African American, you needed a vehicle. And this vehicle, which, by the way, is now at the Smithsonian, was used to drive around the county in South Carolina. It did everything. It was a rolling medical vehicle. It was a rolling medical clinic. It was a rolling schoolhouse. It taught people how to pass the poll test. It taught children. And it registered voters. So you needed a vehicle to get around. And this was the bus that was used by the Jenkins family to register register folks. So the car was essential to the civil rights movement. Another issue was flying into an airport. During the civil rights movement, if you flew into an airport and you were black, you were stuck, because black cab companies were not allowed to, they couldn't get the contracts to pick up people at the airports. the white cab companies had complete control over those contracts. So what do? You can't ride in a white cab. You rent a car. And that became the way that civil rights workers were able to get from the airport to wherever they were going, in whatever city they were flying into. So if you flew into Atlanta and you couldn't get from the airport to your hotel, your black hotel, you had to rent a car. So how does my story end? In 1964, LBJ passes major civil rights legislation that extends voting rights and outlaws segregation. The NAACP and other civil rights organizations had taken test cases. They used Howard Johnson's and Hilton Hotels as major test cases, and they were forced to open them to African Americans. The Heart of Atlanta Motel filed suit against the United States government in 1964, immediately after passage of the legislation, saying that the segregation of public accommodations should not involve him. His name was Morton Rolton. He was the owner of the Heart of Atlanta Motel. It shouldn't involve him because none of his patrons were coming from out of state. He lost. So private businesses also were forced to open their accommodations to African Americans. So the irony is that as the large chain hotels opened to African Americans, the tourist houses, the black hotels, and all of the other recreational businesses that supported African Americans on the road closed. And this was Rock Rest, which gradually closed. People used to stay for a week, gradually closed and lost all of its visitation. But I guess I have to ask, does the story end? Does the story really end? Or does it remain an issue in America for all of us? This is Philando Castile, murdered in his automobile by a Minnesota police officer in 2016 in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, who was afraid of him because of the color of his skin. The officer was acquitted of manslaughter charges. But the murder was captured on a cell phone video, and I'm sure you've all seen that murder. And I thought this was a very apropos, this was in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, an apropos cartoon for the situation that we find ourselves in today. The Green Book went out of business, and the black hotels and motels gradually lost their clientele to the large chain hotels. African Americans had worked so hard to break open the Hilton and the large chain hotels that because they could now stay there, they did stay there. But the American landscape was forever changed with the help of ordinary men and women choosing the automobile and travel as their weapon of choice. The end. Questions? I don't know if that's I'm not a political scientist, I'm a historian, but I don't know if it's because, I think it was, Carter was put together a weird coalition, right? Because as a Democrat, black people were not gonna vote for the Republican, right. So they were gonna vote for the Southerner, right? And he also was able to get white Southerners to vote for him. So I think it was the coalition that, you know, he put together an interesting coalition of people that wouldn't ordinarily vote for the same person. Right. You guys are asking me all kinds of things that are way out of my... I don't think women should be restricted, but I understand their culture, and it's certainly not a culture I'd want to live in. You know, what's really interesting about this story is that very much of it is about men driving. Because men were the drivers. In the 50s, men drove. Women generally didn't drive. Women were sitting next to them. They were the navigators. They were the ones with the maps and things. But women generally didn't drive. But that was more by custom than requirement. Well, and it's very difficult to tell because somebody can come out and say, oh, I'm sorry, we just rented our last room. How would you know? You know, you would never know.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I think the police have been called for so many ridiculous things. You know, the young Yale student.
They segregated us from the room.
Oh, yeah, I know. Police get called for all kinds of crazy things that are ridiculous, and I don't know what the answer to that is. So this book is going to become a documentary film, and Rick Burns and I have been working together on the film. And one of the things that we did was we did a lot of interviews, and we're interviewing scholars. You know, scholars are talking about the research they've done, and what is so interesting is that every scholar, especially the women, we talk about giving our sons, because I have a black son and a black son-in-law, and my son-in-law is big, and he's a structural engineer, so he goes out of the house wearing hoodies all the time, and I'm always saying to him, I don't want you to wear a hoodie. I don't. And oh, Mom, come on. You know, that's what I get. And I don't want you to wear a hoodie. I don't want you to wear those boots. I don't, you know. Yes, type of cars. Yes, absolutely. I'm from New Jersey. I live in upstate New York, but I'm from New Jersey. But I was the kid in the
book about freedom.
I was the clueless kid in the back seat. I was the total clueless kid. My mother's family is from Fayetteville, North Carolina. We went every summer from Newark, New Jersey to Fayetteville, North Carolina, and we would get up at 2:00 in the morning and drive. My father would drive in the dark, and we thought it was ridiculous, my brother and I. We thought, and they would carry all this food, this fried chicken, all this, you know, these shoe boxes full of food, and in a cooler, and, you know, just all this stuff, and we thought, this is ridiculous when we were kids. And I will tell you that I started to really, doing this research, start to understand them and started to understand the rationale for what they were doing. Gas up in New Jersey, you know, figure out where you gas up in Washington, D.C., then you don't have to gas up again after you cross the Mason-Dixon line. You know, why did they have these peculiar habits that I thought were peculiar? I didn't realize
what they were doing.
And then when we were in Fayetteville, we were in a black community. We never left that black community. You know, we just stayed right there. Yes. Oh, no. I had spells where I was really angry. And I had spells where I was very proud of what, you know, I think that black people have done amazing things.
Amazing.
Are just incredibly, you know, creative, and you know the way they've kind of managed to make a way where there was make a way out of no way. Yeah, exactly. That there was absolutely almost nothing that you would expect they could do with roadblocks at every single step of the way. There was a roadblock, but they found a way around it. And I felt very proud of what black people had accomplished in this country. With so many roadblocks put in their way, I couldn't even imagine. You know, my father, and I put this in the book, my father told me, he remembers his first memory when he was 5 years old was sitting where he lived on the porch of a two-room, he called it a two-room house. And I said to him, a two-room house? In Jefferson County, South Carolina, what is a two-room house? It was either a slave cabin or it was a sharecropper cabin.
Yep.
He grew up to go to college, to become an engineer, you know, to have a house, to have a, you know, two cars and a family. And I couldn't imagine coming from that to, you know, how far he had come with all of the obstacles that got put in, you know, in their way. I just really, you know, and I think black families often hide a lot of that from their kids. So I had a tremendous pride about what we as people have accomplished given what we have had to deal with. But there's also research that shows that high blood pressure and the stress is a lot of the psychological damage. It's like PTSD. It really has. It creates a lot of psychological damage for children, but also for adults. And to hide that from your children is, you know, it's kind of your job. No, I think you're absolutely right. There are so many kind of ways to go. One of the other areas that I'm very interested in is at the end of the book, I couldn't talk to police in this country. Police in this country don't want to talk. But I did talk to the commandant of police in Montreal. And what he said was that the police in Montreal are taught that their job is problem solving this much and this much law enforcement, not law enforcement. And because that their job is problem solving, they have a problem in Montreal with Hasidic Jews that when it's getting dark on Shabbos, on the Sabbath, if it suddenly gets dark and they're in a traffic jam and they're in their car, the car's running, and they just get out of it, leave it right in the middle of the road, leave it running, walk away, go home. And he
Can
said,
I explain why that is?
Yep. No, because they can't do any work after the sun goes down. And if the sun goes down, you know, goes down 4 o'clock sometimes, they're stuck. And they had this problem of these guys leaving their cars like right in the middle of the road. And what his message was very interesting. He said, don't go and arrest the guy. Don't have their car put in the lockup, you know, impound. Don't have it towed. Don't put them into the system. You create this whole bureaucratic mess. He said, think about solving the problem. The problem is that they had to get home because of their religion. He said, get in the car, the keys are in it, pull it over to the side. You have solved a problem, and you have kept all this bureaucratic nonsense from happening. That's your job. That's not, but if you think my job is law enforcement, you go find the guy, you arrest him, you put him in the system, you tow his car, you put it in the impound, and you create all these problems. The guy's just trying to follow his religion, for crying out loud, solve a problem. And if our police would think about solving problems, de-escalating arguments instead of escalating them, and if they would think about not being afraid. One of the things he said was, we put a lot of energy into shooting, right? Learning, you gotta go to the firing range all the time. Every month, you gotta be at that firing range, learning to shoot. But they don't do the same thing, learning to problem solve, to deal with people. It wasn't that all black people stopped patronizing black businesses. It was that some did because they had fought so hard to open up the white businesses. The problem was that white people did not embrace black businesses. There were plenty of wonderful black businesses. If a few white people had used those businesses, they just didn't. But there was also a push in the 60s for integration. And there was actually a guide called Travel Guide, was the name of it, that was a guide that listed places that supported integration. So for whites, for liberal whites, it listed places that liberal whites could go and encounter black people. And it was, you know, so each one of the guides had its own goal, and they were all different. There was one of the guides that was just for show people. You know, they had a lot of dentists and put caps on your teeth and, you know, places. You know, so depending on what you were looking for, your guide might tell you that. So if you were looking for integration, that was for both blacks and whites. You know, if you were a show person and you were looking for places that show people would be interested in, you know, there were lots of very specific guides. But integration was a goal at that time. It came at a cost. That's the irony. That's the irony, because during segregation, which is a horrible time in our history, during segregation, those businesses flourished.